Emerson Green, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you for having me.
What got you into YouTube? We both do a similar thing here in this space. You've been doing it for several years, and so I wonder, like, what motivates you as you are doing the YouTube thing in philosophy?
Well, it started off, I guess, just as inquiring into the nature of God and religion. And, you know, a lot of times you get into philosophy because there's some big question that kind of haunts you and propels you towards, you know, going deeper into these things. And for me, that was God's existence in Christianity. And then there are these related questions that come up along the way. And for me, consciousness and philosophy of mind, I guess, is kind of like my main interest now. But it started off with philosophy of religion and, you know, it started with like basic apologetic stuff. And then that eventually led to philosophy. So, you know, began just like blogging about Christian apologetics, and then you eventually start reaching out to like academic philosophers, and you find out that they're actually pretty eager to talk about their work, and they're happy to do that if you're actually reading it and you know are interested in it. And yeah, that's just really fun. It's like fun to bring on Michael Humer and Philip Goff and Ralph Stefan Weir and all these other philosophers who I really admire, and then, you know, they'll give you their time and you can talk to them about your work, which is great for me because, you know, I find their work fascinating and relevant to the questions that I care about the most. And I just thought that was really cool that, you know, like I didn't really care for school very much, but I loved office hours. And I guess I kind of view that like this is like an extension of that where it's like,
right,
okay, I want to talk to you, you know, privately for a couple hours. And yeah, it's just a lot of fun, and it's relevant to the questions that bother me the most.
Mm. Did you start as a Christian? Was that the entrance into apologetics, philosophy of religion, or did you start from a more skeptical, atheistic perspective?
I sort of started from a more skeptical, atheistic perspective because for me, like leaving Christianity, like I didn't know anything about philosophy or really even apologetics, and I was kind of sent to an apologetics camp, like a summer camp.
Okay, wow. I didn't know that was a thing. An apologetics summer camp?
Yeah, it's called Summit. It's in Colorado.
Okay.
And it was actually a lot of fun, but I think it was awesome. It didn't have the intended effect that they wanted it to have on me, but I also met my wife there, so that was cool. But
that is so cool.
You know, it's like 2 weeks. I think it's like 80 hours of lectures. And it's just like Christian apologetics. You know, one of the speakers was Frank Turek. Like it's that level of, you know, it's not like really deep stuff, but it was the first time I'd ever encountered any of that. Like, you know, it's the first time I heard the word epistemology, and I'm like, wait, there's a whole field of study where they just ask questions like that. Like, I didn't know that existed, but once I did, I was like, okay, I like this. This is the thing that I want to read about.
How old were you at the time?
19.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that is about the time, too, that I got into all of this and fell in love with it as well. And obviously, here I am. I love this whole, like, just long-form conversation with philosophers that I've been reading for so long. I mean, it's just so cool to, like, meet these people. And then to, specifically, I think, to, like, ask them your questions. Like, you can write down your question in the margin of a paper or a book chapter and be like, I wonder about this or this objection. But then to, like, bring them on and to just ask them directly, like, that's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and the thing is, like, every objection or novel insight that I think I've had, it's like, oh, yeah, this is the first question that every idiot asks. And I'm like, oh, great.
Right. And but, you're like, okay, I'm not that original.
But, yeah, it is... It is fun. And there is this huge divide, though, between like YouTube land and academic philosophy land.
Okay, in what respect?
And I guess, like, well, you know, like, I don't really view my channel as like an education channel. Like, it is pretty much like a selfishly oriented project. Like, I'm not doing like a public service. It's pretty much all just my own interests. But, you know, there, like, for instance, when it comes to the moral argument for God, there's like what passes for insight on YouTube and like, you know, apologetics blogs and books, and then there's metaethics, and there's virtually no overlap. So like the moral argument relies entirely on metaethics, but no one seems to know anything about metaethics, like professional metaethics. So I do try to like bridge that divide a little bit where I bring things from like academic moral philosophy and metaethics and try to apply it to like what apologists are saying about the moral argument for God. And, you know, that's like a Sisyphean struggle for me. I don't know why that particular argument bothers me so much, but, you know, there's, like I said, there's virtually no overlap between the things that apologists say and the things that, like, academic metaethicists say.
That might be the case in with respect to the moral argument, but I think you'd agree that, like, one of the objections that's often raised against the legitimacy of philosophy of religion is that it is, at times, almost coextensive with apologetics. Like, it doesn't even seem, at times, doesn't even seem to hide its intentions of building a case for the existence of God or the plausibility of certain Christian doctrines, where it's not like open to the possibility that these things are false. It's explicitly developed with the aim of defending them and showing them to be true. So in that respect, you know, insofar as you think philosophy of religion is philosophy, there's going to be a lot of overlap between apologetics and philosophy of religion, right? I mean, you kind of see that point.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, in that sense, there's a lot of overlap. Like, a lot of philosophers of religion probably started out as apologists, and a lot of apologists, like, draw from the work of philosophers of religion. But every once in a while, there's just this huge gap, like,
yeah. You know,
specifically with the moral argument, that's what got me the most. And I think, to some extent, philosophy of mind, like, it's widely assumed that if you're an atheist, you have to be a materialist, and if you're a Christian, sure. You have to be some kind of dualist. And I don't think that's forced on you at all. Like, the non-physicalists who are, like, leading the charge in academic philosophy of mind are pretty much all atheists, like Thomas Nagel and David Chalmers. Like, those are two extremely prominent, influential philosophers. Noam Chomsky, and even, like, in history, like, Nietzsche and Schopenhauer were not physicalists. But, yeah, I think that, yeah, you're definitely right that there's an agenda, you know. And yeah. I think that that's, like, sort of a problem because philosophy is ostensibly about, like, searching for knowledge and truth and wisdom, and it's like if you come in thinking, okay, I have to like prove, you know, my pre-existing worldview, yeah, that's a problem. But I think, I don't know, in my experience, like, these philosophers of religion who are Christians are actually like pretty good about being modest and exploring things. Like, usually it's only when it comes to like their specific religious doctrines that it seems like they stop being philosophers. Like, if they're Catholic, like, when it comes to Catholicism, it seems like they kind of switch modes of being a little bit. But when they're talking about, like, God's existence or, you know, like, bigger picture questions, I don't view them as different from any other philosophers. Like, I know that they want to prove God's existence, but they don't strike me as, like, excessively confident or, like, you know, unwilling to examine things. Like, it seems like, you know, people like Josh Rasmussen or, you know, Dustin Crummett, like, they strike me as, like, totally honest, good faith actors and, like, really good philosophers. Like, I would never, like, impugn their motives or anything like that. Like, I think they're smarter than I am. Like, not that that's a very high bar to clear, but still, I think that they're, like, really good philosophers and I, you know, admire their work. But I have noticed that, like, when it starts getting to, like, specific religious elements of their view, not them specifically, but just, like, in general, right. Like, if you're talking about eternal conscious torment or, like, this or that defeat a dogma or something, it's just like, okay, it doesn't really seem like they're acting the same when it comes to that stuff, but, you know, maybe that's a different arena.
So philosophy of mind, would you say that's your like primary interest, your main passion within philosophy, or is it just kind of one among many? Because that's the one we're here to discuss today. So I was curious, did you suggest that because that's like the main one that really gets you going?
It's the one I think about the most these days. You know, I guess it used to be pretty much philosophy of religion and then, you know, epistemology to some extent and metaethics and philosophy of mind, I guess. Yeah, philosophy of mind is probably currently like my main interest. But yeah, that's why I suggested it.
So you sent me a list of three arguments, which are arguments against physicalism. And so before we get into them, into the specifics, I wanted to ask you about the significance of these arguments if you grant their conclusion. They show that physicalism is false. But does that mean that they are arguments for substance dualism? They are arguments for a soul? And if not, why not? What are the views in between a like physicalism on one side and the soul on the other? What falls in between those that are consistent with these arguments?
Well, I mean, yeah, these arguments are just for the rejection of physicalism. And there's, you know, a number of non-physicalist views. In addition to substance dualism, there's also property dualism, which is viewed as, like, you know, more modest and more plausible. I'm not so sure about that, but it's viewed as, like, a more modest thesis than substance dualism, where, yeah, you're a physical body, but you have non-physical properties for some reason. And you could believe in mental causation and be a property dualist, or you could be an epiphenomenalist, which means right. that your mind has, like, no causal influence over your body. But there's also other middle way options, like I lean in favor of Russellian panpsychism, which is just the view that, you know, like there's the physical world, but there's more to the physical world than what is just austerely given to us by physics. Like physics gives us language that's, you know, pretty mathematical. It's like mathematical gnomic description. And the thought is that there's more to the world than that. Like there can't literally just be math. There has to be like something that is doing the things that we're describing. Like we're describing behavior and structure and relations, but there has to be something that's doing the behaving. You know, there has to be something that has the mathematical structure that's given to us by physics, and that's consciousness. So, you know, we can describe the brain physically, but the intrinsic nature of the brain is consciousness. Right. So there's still only like one substance. It's like a conscious mental substance. But it's like mental subjectively from the inside and objectively physical from the outside. And the basis for that identity kind of permeates the natural world. And then, of course, there's like idealism. There's like a subjective form of idealism, which just says that there's nothing but consciousness. So like when you look at a table, you can like touch the table. You could hear your hand knock against the table. I guess you could smell and taste the table if you were so inclined. But like if you stripped away all these sense impressions of the table, there would just be nothing left. Like right. there's nothing beyond just, you know, the impressions of a table that you get empirically. There are also objective forms of idealism that are basically just panpsychism. There's also neutral monism, which, you know, some people challenge whether that's like a legitimate alternative or not, but it says like there are two forms. You know, there's a substance that is not physical and it's not mental. It's like some mysterious third thing. And sometimes neutral monists say, well, that's actually both mental and physical. And again, it seems like you're kind of back to the panpsychism option there. There's also Mysterianism, which is kind of my third favorite option after panpsychism and substance dualism, which basically is just giving up. And I'm a huge fan of giving up because it seems like there are probably things that are beyond our ken. Like, you know, you have to recognize that we evolved and that we have like limitations. You know, it would kind of be absurd to think that, for instance, like a dog could understand anything in principle. Like it could understand general relativity if you just tried to teach it hard enough. And I don't see why that wouldn't apply to us. And you know, some people like Colin McGinn have suggested this is one of those areas where we're just a dog trying to understand general relativity, and we're just never really going to have like a satisfying explanation of consciousness. And Eric Schwitzkobel has also argued this in a different vein. But yeah, I mean, that's also non-physicalism, but it's not really like substance dualism. So I mean, off the top of my head, I guess those are the options that I think of the most. There's probably others that I'm not thinking of, and there's probably, you know, future theories that we can't even conceive of. But one that I did just think of is Paul Draper's etherism. I made a video about this. I believe it's the only video on YouTube that exists about this view of mind.
Okay.
He kind of gets it from William James, and you could argue that it fits into one of these categories already, but it's basically the idea that there's like a field of consciousness that exists alongside the other fundamental forces that we already know about. And the physical world interacts with this field, but there's really just this one permeating field of consciousness. There's like one world soul. And, you know, whether or not it counts as physical, it depends on how you elaborate the hypothesis. But, yeah, I mean, that's another view. And you could subdivide all these views into, you know, into further categories. But yeah, I think that's like roughly the landscape as I understand it.
This is a tangent, but I like tangents. The Paul Drape review, that consciousness is a field that pervades the universe, is the idea then that, like, our finite minds, like, arise out of this field, that mental states arise as some sort of interaction between the consciousness field and physical forces somehow?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like our consciousness seems individuated because we have different physical bodies, but there's really just like one conscious mind that we're a part of. And, you know, it kind of implies that there's an afterlife of some kind. Yeah, I didn't come prepared to talk about it.
No, that's okay. Neither did I.
2 seconds ago. But, but yeah, that's roughly the idea. And whether you think of it as physical or as like kind of akin to a soul. Yeah, and this isn't a view that Draper endorses, by the way. He just views it as like an alternative that is under discussed, and like it seems to have some advantages and some strange implications. But yeah, I think it's an interesting view. It's like worthy of consideration.
Yeah, well, Paul Draper is quickly becoming one of my all-time favorite philosophers. So if he's talking about it, you should be thinking about it.
He's the goat.
What is physicalism? What does that mean? Because I think, you know, even if you give a characterization of it's all facts are physical facts, all things are physical things, well, that just leads to my very next question, which is, what is it to be physical? It's actually not that straightforward to give an answer. Anyway, what do you have to say?
I mean, I agree. Lots of people have, you know, inquired about the nature of the physical. Like, Daniel Stoljar has written a lot about how it's hard to find like an essential core of physicalism. Right. Noam Chomsky has written about how it's hard to give like a good conceptual analysis of the physical. I'm not sure that's such a big problem. I mean, physicalism, at least what it says on the brochure, is that consciousness is a purely physical phenomenon. You know, your brain and your mind are one and the same. And physicalists disagree significantly about the details of that, and those details lead to different commitments, and that becomes relevant when we're talking about arguments against physicalism. But, I mean, that's basically the idea, is that, like, consciousness is identical to or constituted by or something the brain. You know, like, it's constituted by the brain, it's identical to the brain, something like that. They also usually at least imply that consciousness came late in the history of the universe and biological evolution. So for a physicalist, consciousness is like a higher order phenomenon that's like localized. It's only found in organisms with complex nervous systems. It's not something that's just meant to rule out like panpsychism, because Galen Strawson has argued that that's actually a form of physicalism, and he's right about that. But it kind of violates like the spirit of physicalism. It doesn't really seem like you're a physicalist anymore if you're saying that, you know, everything is made of consciousness. But you know, technically, he is right if you want to go down that path. Like, it does seem like a legitimate form of physicalism, panpsychism. But another thing is, I use physicalism and materialism interchangeably, which historically was not the case, but most philosophers these days seem to use them interchangeably. But yeah, physicalism and the notion of the physical is famously hard to define. But I think the position actually comes into greater focus when you're talking about arguments against physicalism, because they don't all respond to, like, you know, the conceivability argument the same way.
Yeah.
And that's when it becomes helpful to kind of like divide up, oh, there's type A physicalism and type B physicalism and type C physicalism. Like, that, if you just start off with that, it's like, what are you talking about? But if you already know how different people respond to like common non-physicalist arguments, you know, then it becomes more useful.
So we begin with the first argument against physicalism, which is Philip Goff's phenomenal transparency argument. What's this? What's this argument?
I'm like increasingly of the opinion that this is pretty much what it all comes down to. Like, if the conceivability argument works, it probably works because Goff is right about phenomenal transparency. But I guess we could start with like a thought experiment to kind of drive the point home. So imagine that we live in a far off possible world where round things and red things are always correlated. And I got this example from Brian Cutter. I like this thought experiment. So it's just a curious fact that like every sphere is red and every red thing is a sphere. There are no blue spheres or like red squares or anything. And it seems, you know, totally self-evident that these are not the same. Like being round is not the same thing as being red. And it's like, it's a really interesting fact that these things seem lawfully correlated, but it just seems obvious that these are not the same thing, right? And someone in that world who has kind of a reductionist mindset and, you know, a taste for like desert ontology, they might think like, well, redness just is roundness, or like redness grounds the roundness, or, you know, roundness is constituted by redness or something like that. I don't even know what it means to say there's a blue sphere or something like that. And then if I disputed that, they'd say, oh, what are you using to say there could be a blue sphere? Intuition? It's like, yeah, definitely. What about it? So yeah, I mean, it seems intuitively obvious that these are not the same thing, but you could make conceivability arguments. Like you could run these arguments where it's like, oh, well, I can conceive of a blue sphere. I can conceive of, a red square, and, that seems to indicate that they're possible, so they can't be identical. But like foundationally, the thing that's driving this is that they just don't seem like the same thing. So this is the position that non-physicalists find themselves in, where you're talking about the brain, you're talking about the things that neuroscientists deal with, you know, those physical properties, like the rate at which neurons fire in Hertz, or you know, the behavior of synapses and acetylcholine and sodium ion channels and things like that. And then it's like, okay, is any of that the feeling of pain? No, like these, if you picture a physical brain, like holding it in your hands, it's like, this is just a wet glob of tissue. This seems at least conceptually distinct from like a thought or, you know, the feeling of pain. If you just tell me, like point blank, that a thought is a physical object, I'm not really going to know what you're talking about at first, because it seems like all I'm saying, like, don't read too much into this. I'm just saying, prima facie, it seems as if a thought is not a physical object. Okay. And like, we can go different directions with that. We can be like Dan Dennett and say, well, you know, when I squint just right, I can kind of see what these non-physicalists are talking about, but I've learned not to credit the hunch. So it's like, I think everybody has this intuition. Yes. I mean, I think it's just my personal opinion. Everyone has this intuition. But like Dennett, they don't trust the intuition. Like he said, I've learned not to credit the hunch. And that's what I did when I was a physicalist. I was like, okay, I can kind of see the hard problem of consciousness, but I've learned not to credit the hunch. I don't trust the intuition. And we don't stop with the intuition, obviously, but, you know, I'm just kind of setting the table here. Like, initially, these don't seem like the same thing. And I think that's significant, but we should just start there, that, like, this seems, you know, physical things and mental things don't initially appear to be the same. They seem to be, you know, distinct, just like red things and round things seem to be distinct. And even if we lived in a world where they happened to be always correlated, it's like, wow, that's a really interesting fact that they seem to be lawfully connected in this way. But that doesn't mean that they're literally the same thing, like identical, or one is constituted by the other or something. So I guess that brings us to phenomenal transparency. So I think the reason that like the roundness and redness case is compelling is because we kind of have a grip on what roundness is and what redness is. So, you know, also, just thinking about the roundness and redness case, if you just switch out redness with the phenomenal appearance of red and roundness with, you know, a particular physical property or object or something, nothing seems to change for me. And like, that's what the non-physicalists are saying. It's like, okay, the appearance of red and a particular physical object or process or whatever, again, they just seem like different things. So why is that significant, though? I think it's because we understand the nature of, you know, consciousness. I think we know something about consciousness in virtue of being conscious and being able to reflect on it. So if you're trying to make these kinds of conceivability arguments where it's like, well, I can conceive of a body without a mind, or a mind without a body, or, you know, I can conceive of a blue sphere or something, what is really relevant, I think, like, this is what Goff identified, is that what's really relevant is like whether you understand the essence, whether you grasp the essence of the entities involved. So like if you know what you're talking about, basically, when you say, well, I can conceive of X without Y, it's like, okay, well, let's back up a step. Do you grasp the essence of X and the essence of Y? Do you understand the nature of these things that you're talking about? Because if you don't, then who cares that you can conceive of X without Y or Y without X? It's like if you say, well, you know, I can conceive of X without Y, but I have no earthly idea what X is or what Y is. It's like, okay, well, then who cares? Like, what good is your conceiving? But if you grasp the essence, if you grasp the nature of these things that we're talking about, and you can still make this conceivability move, then it seems like you're on pretty good footing. It seems like if you understand the nature of consciousness and you understand the nature of the physical, then you seem to be in the same position as the person who's making a conceivability argument about red things and round things. So it just comes down to, like, do we understand the nature of the physical, you know, through empirical investigation, and also to some extent, like, through, like, a priori reasoning, because physics is extremely mathematical. But it's like, do we understand the nature of the physical, and do we understand the nature of consciousness? Like, do we grasp the essence of a painful experience by feeling pain and being able to reflect on that? So Goff says that we do, and this may shock you, but I think he's right about that. So I think that you can put the point kind of intuitively. There are a couple arguments for it, but the idea is just that something like pain is just a feeling. You know, like, pain is just a particular type of feeling that feels a certain way. So there's really no gap here between, like, the appearance property and its essence. Like, that's how Chalmers would put it. Like, there's the appearance property of, you know, such and such, and then there's its essence. You can drive a wedge between these things very often, but not when it comes to conscious experiences. Like, not when it comes to something like pain. Pain just is a feeling. So if you have felt the feeling and you can reflect on its nature, you grasp the phenomenal concept of pain, then you know what it is. You're done. Like, you know what pain is by feeling it, because it just is a feeling. And like I said, I'm just kind of putting the point intuitively, but there are some arguments for it. I mean, I ultimately think they're unnecessary, because it's just kind of obvious that when you feel pain, like, sorry, I don't want to repeat myself like 20 times, but it's kind of hard. So if you're feeling, well, hang on, let me put the point this way. You can often put a gap between, like, the thing itself, its essence, and the effect it has on the minds of observers. So you can say, like, well, look, I know what water is in the sense that I know its appearance properties. Like, I know the effects it has on the minds of observers, but you don't know that it's H2O necessarily. Like, our ancestors knew about water. They didn't know it was H2O. Okay, like, you can do that with heat. You can do that with all kinds of physical things where you can say, well, look, I didn't actually know that heat was, like, you know, kinetic energy or something like, or motion or whatever. I didn't know that water was H2O, but I did know the effects it has on the minds of observers. Okay, you can't really open up that same wedge with pain. You can't say, like, well, I know how pain feels, but I don't know what pain is. Like, I know the effects it has on the minds of observers, but I don't know what it is. It's like, the effects on the minds of observers is exactly what we're talking about here. Like, that is the target phenomenon. So you can't really make that same move of saying, well, no, you're thinking of the effects on the minds of observers, not the thing itself. The thing that we're talking about is a feeling. It is the effects on the minds of observers. So, anyway, I think that if you know how pain feels, then you know what it is, because pain is a feeling. So, I mean, roughly speaking, that's phenomenal transparency. It's just the idea that you grasp the essence of a concept by possessing it. Like, once you grasp the phenomenal concept, you understand the nature of the, you know, the entity it refers to, in this case, pain.
So I will raise some questions about that, but let's grant that for the moment, that experiences are transparent in this way, that conscious experiences are transparent. How is that incompatible then with physicalism about mental states?
Well, the idea that phenomenal transparency is true, so it's phenomenal concepts are these essence revealing concepts, right? So physicalists are telling us that, like, well, the essence of a painful experience is C fibers firing, or whatever the neural state is supposed to be. So if you think that these phenomenal concepts, you know, reveal their essence, and you think the essence of pain is C fibers firing, then that means that neuroscience should be very easy. It means that it should be like a priori that pain is C fibers firing. And, you know, it's obviously not. That's not the kind of thing that you can work out from the armchair. You have to do empirical investigation. So, like, in order to say that, well, these experiences you're having, their essence is actually some physical state, you have to say that these phenomenal concepts are opaque. You can't say that they're transparent. And physicalists are aware of this. They do defend the idea that phenomenal concepts are opaque, just the same as water. So, like, water is an opaque concept where you can be familiar with the appearance properties of water, but you never really know it's H2O until you go out and do some science. You have to do some empirical investigation. You can't figure it out from the armchair that water is H2O. They're saying that consciousness is like that, where pain, you actually have no clue what it is. You don't know what the essential nature of pain is just by feeling it and reflecting on it. You have to go do some empirical investigation. So in order for that to work, you have to say that phenomenal concepts are opaque. They're just, as Philip puts it, they're kind of blind pointers. Like, you're sort of pointing inside yourself and saying, that thing, I know not what, you know, whatever that is, could be anything, could turn out to be a pizza for all you know. You have no clue what it is. So physicalists are aware of this. They accept it. They accept the burden of saying that phenomenal concepts are opaque, just like water. But if you accept phenomenal transparency, then you can't really be a physicalist because it, like I said, it kind of implies that a lot of things should be a priori that are obviously not. So in order to defend the physicalist position, in order to say, for instance, like, the most popular form of physicalism is a posteriori physicalism, which kind of borrows from Kripke and Putnam and says, like, oh, the mind-brain identity, it's like an a posteriori identity. You can't work it out a priori that consciousness is physical, but it's a discovery of science that consciousness is physical. And in order for that to work, you have to say that phenomenal opacity is true. You have to say that, you know, phenomenal concepts are, they're blind pointers. They're opaque. They're not essence-revealing concepts. So even though pain is a feeling and you've felt the feeling and can reflect on it, you just have no earthly idea what it is. You know, you have to defend a view like that in order to say that they're a posteriori identical.
Couldn't the physicalist affirm partial transparency of mental states? So, you know, if I thrust my hand into an open flame, I become intimately acquainted with the feeling of burning, as I know its felt quality. And then I could say that is part of the essential nature of being in pain or feeling like one's hand is burning, that conscious experience. So I'm acquainted with part of the essential nature, and that is true. But I'm not acquainted with all of it. Part of the essential nature of that experience is a C-fibering event as well. So they don't have to affirm, like, total opacity or total transparency. They can affirm some halfway position. I don't even know if that's coherent, but that is just off the top of my head.
Yeah. So Philip Goff talks about that possibility. He calls it translucency.
There you go. I like that.
it still works in the non-physicalist's favor. Like, non-physicalists, at least Russellian monists, don't actually have to go all the way to transparency. They could just affirm translucency, where it's like, we are revealed some part of the essence of pain by feeling it and reflecting on it. Yeah. And that's really as far as you need to go to make the argument work. So translucency is also a problem for type B physicalists. Like, David Papineau, who's like a very prominent type B physicalist, he says that phenomenal concepts are opaque, that they're like blind pointers. And he also thinks that about most of our concepts, maybe all of our fundamental concepts, which is weird because it seems like he wouldn't really understand anything if that were the case. But the translucency stuff, it works in the same way. Like, you really have to block off this transparency stuff, like, in totality, if you want to go the a posteriori identity route. And that's, like, borne out in the literature. I don't really have it on hand, like, you know, the nuances of how translucency factors in. But in Consciousness and Fundamental Reality, which is, like, the main book that I'm drawing from of Goff, he makes the case that, like, you can affirm transparency and still make these arguments as a non-physicalist, but the physicalist...
Translucency.
Yeah. Transparency right. or translucency, you'll be fine. Okay. But for the physicalist, you really are going to be backed into this like strong opacity position. If you want to say that like, oh, you know, consciousness in the brain is just like water in H2O. Well, the reason that worked is because water is an opaque concept. You know, it's not a translucent concept or a transparent concept. You have to be kind of blocked off from the essence of water a priori. And if you want to really go that route as a physicalist, you have to do the same with consciousness. Say that we just don't know the essence of consciousness, even though we're conscious. The having is just not the knowing in any sense.
So I just want to make sure I'm understanding the argument correctly. So an opaque concept is one whose essence we cannot determine a priori.
Right.
So then water is an example where it is the essence of water to be H2O. And that is something we only discovered much later when we developed atomic theory and the standard model of particle physics and got a microscope, understood atomic structure. But we know then after the fact, a posteriori, we know that that is the essence of water. And so what is it? Water is an opaque concept in that case because its essential nature is not determinable just by thinking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like even an ideal reasoner sitting in the armchair, like they know about water. Well, you're not really going to know that it's H2O. You have to empirically investigate the world. So, I mean, like the post Kripke Putnam orthodoxy in philosophy is that water is essentially H2O, but this is like an a posteriori necessity. It's not something you can work out from the armchair. And physicalists are in the habit of saying that, well, I mean, if you listen to physicalists long enough, you'll find out that the key to understanding consciousness is understanding water and H2O. It's like their favorite analogy ever. But yeah, they, it's supposed to be the same thing. Like if you want to say, cause after that, after, you know, the a posteriori necessity stuff, physicalists were like, oh, hey, we should say that about consciousness and the brain, because then we won't have to, you know, say that it's like a priori, you know, cause there's this really implausible, like type A physicalist view that says there's an a priori entailment from the physical to the phenomenal. Or I guess you could be like super Quinean and say, I don't even think in these concepts. But like once physicalists realized they didn't have to do that, they pretty much all stopped doing that. And then they said, oh, I'm a type B physicalist. You know, I believe that this is an a posteriori necessity like water and H2O. So, yeah.
So, and the reason that translucency is incompatible with type B physicalism is because the type B physicalist, if they're an identity theorist, if they think that mental states just are identical to certain brain states, could never affirm that the essential nature of the experience of being in pain is only partly being a certain neural state plus some sort of irreducible phenomenal quality. That wouldn't be to express an identity between the physical and the mental. Is that the reason?
Something like that. I mean, I don't have it at my fingertips right now. I'd have to go back and read what the arguments are. Which, by the way, if people haven't read this book, this is a fantastic book, Consciousness and Fundamental Reality. But yeah, I can't really give it off the top of my head. I defend transparency, type B physicalists defend opacity. There are some middle ways, like you're right, and then it complicates things a bit, but yeah, I mean, that's roughly how I see it.
Well, why think there are phenomenal properties at all, Emerson? What if we were just eliminativists, I guess, or a newer term being illusionists about phenomenal properties and states of consciousness? I have always thought and still do think that that's a crazy view. I can't even understand how you can affirm it, but some people do. What is going on there? Do they really think that like there is no internal perspective or what it is like of experience, that it's all an illusion? Like, what does that even mean?
I don't know. I mean, I've sort of calmed down about this point over the last few years. Like when I first found out about it, it like made me angry.
I
think of like, it's, I don't know. There's no point getting mad about stuff like this. Like I remember someone saying academic debates are so heated because there's so little at stake, because the stakes are so low. That's why they are. Get so mad. But you know, it does seem like on its face wrong. And you know, the people who affirm this view are like very, like slippery about it. Like Dennett wrote a paper called On the Absence of Phenomenology, which seems pretty straightforward, you know, like, okay, he's saying that there is no phenomenology. But like, if you try to put that to them, they, like I said, they get kind of upset. And I don't really know why. I don't understand. Like, if you say, well, you guys don't believe consciousness exists, like I said, they will get upset. But when I say consciousness, I mean phenomenal consciousness. You know, I mean the what it's like of experience. Like, that's pretty much what we're all talking about here. Right. And they say, oh, well, of course I don't believe in that, but I do believe in, you know, functional states and behavior and so on. It's like, well, yeah, so do I, but that's not what I'm talking about. I don't think that stuff is even particularly hard to explain. But yeah, so I think that there are some clever arguments for that view. Like, I don't want to be totally dismissive of it, but it does just, that view just does contradict a datum. Like, we know that phenomenal consciousness exists quite directly. Like, I think that you know you're conscious because, or I mean, I think you know consciousness exists because you're conscious. Like, if you were just observing third personally, like if you're just using scientific instruments, you'd have no reason to believe in consciousness. Like, it's not something that's publicly observable. It's a private phenomenon. And, you know, this troubles them and it leads to all kinds of complications. And, you know, they raise valid questions about like how you can even scientifically approach this question if you disagree with them. And they're right about some of that. Like, it, my view is much harder to square with science than their view. But the reason that I hold this view is because I think consciousness exists because I'm conscious. Like, and I think that you have to, it very quickly gets into questions of like fundamental epistemology.
Yeah.
Which we do differ on. You know, like a lot of these people have different ideas about epistemology than I do. And you have to in order to affirm like the type A view, which kind of rejects phenomenal consciousness. But yeah, I think that if I were to try to like steel man that view, it's like the best argument for it that I'm aware of is something like, well, okay, what if we explained our judgments that we're conscious? Like, what if I could explain your disposition to say things like I'm conscious and, you know, all the things I just said, what if I could explain your behavior there? Like, what if I explained your judgments that you're phenomenally conscious, like your judgment that there's a hard problem of consciousness? Would that count as explaining the hard problem of consciousness? It's like, in a way, it kind of would. So I think that's like a clever approach. Like, that's sort of like David Chalmers' meta problem of consciousness. Like, can we explain why we come to this judgment that there's a hard problem? And it's like, if you do that, does that adequately explain the hard problem? Like, if I can explain psychologically why you're disposed to think these things and say these things, does that count as an explanation of the hard problem? It's like,
well,
kind of. I don't know.
But if you're going to be a consistent eliminativist, you can't talk about thinking, right? And if you talk about psychology and like believing and why do you think that, I mean, those are mental states. And so if you delete those two, then I feel like what you're left saying is, can I explain like certain behavioral outputs? You know, the fact of you saying certain things and doing certain things. And it's like, yeah, then you just explain that as a certain like reaction given a certain brain state at one time and external inputs, then this is what happens. But then that quickly looks like something you could apply with equal force to, well, okay, now I said you could apply that with equal force to a philosophical zombie. But these people are saying that we are philosophical zombies. It's basically what they're saying. Which is just crazy. I mean,
yeah, it does seem crazy. I'm inclined to think it is crazy, but you know, what they're trying to explain is like, you know, verbal behavior. Like, if I say, why do I think I'm conscious, or why am I saying I'm conscious? They're just thinking of that in like functional terms,
yes,
and behavioral terms, and yeah, just like purely physical description. And you know, obviously that exists, and they're just thinking, well, what else is there? Like, especially if you're just using the tools of science, like what else should we include in our data set? And I'm saying we should include the data of consciousness.
Right.
We don't know about it the same way that we know about empirical discoveries, like having to do with neuroscience. We know about it in a completely different way. And they're saying like, well, I don't accept that as part of the data set. Like, I have a different fundamental epistemology, and I don't think this is something in our ontology that's well established that we have to explain. It's like, okay, Well, if you just get rid of that, then yeah, I agree that your theory makes a lot of sense. It's actually a really great, theoretically virtuous approach to understanding consciousness if you just get rid of the thing that made the hard problem hard,
right?
Like from the outset. But yeah, I like David Chalmers and like other people who've, you know, by the way, David Chalmers assigns like a 10% credence to illusionism. So it's not really? That like no non-physicalist takes this seriously. Like most non-physicalists, I think, have the same feelings as Galen Strawson about it, which is like, this is the silliest claim anyone has ever seriously made. But, you know, David Chalmers thinks that there's like something to it. Philip Goff thinks there's something to it. But ultimately, it's just like, you're just kind of contradicting a datum. Like, you're just rejecting something that is part of our data set that needs to be explained. And yes, we don't know about this datum the same way that we know about other things in science. Like, we didn't go out, make some observations and say, oh my gosh, there's this consciousness stuff. How do we explain that?
Right.
That's not what happened. We just know about it directly. And that's the only reason we even know about it in the first place. It's the only way you could know about it. And yeah, they kind of start off fundamentally and saying like, okay, we need to talk about epistemology and including this in the data set in the first place. Plus, like, what's your theory of your own mind? Like, do you, like, because they have a particular theory about what's going on, like with, you know, the Cartesian theater and introspective reports, and they try to cast doubt on, you know, introspection. And which, by the way, like, illusionists often say true things. I don't know if I want to say often say, they sometimes say true things about consciousness that are valuable, you know. Like, sometimes they have led me to be skeptical about my own like introspective reports. And I think there's definitely a place for like some amount of skepticism about introspection. I just don't think it does all the heavy lifting that they think it does, where you can start like changing the data set and all that. Like, but yeah, I think there's definitely a place for like some limited skepticism towards introspection as a means to knowing things. Like, introspection can be misleading, just like your senses can be misleading. But I just don't think that that gets you all the way to the place where they want you to be. But yeah, I you know, I try to no longer be angry at illusionists, and I'm usually successful in that these days. I don't know. I guess I'm just chilling out a bit in my extremely old age as I approach death and the flame is closer to being extinguished. I don't know. I guess I just chill out a bit. I'm like, oh, okay. But yeah, if you want to know more about it, you could talk to like Pete Mandick or, you know, someone like that. I really appreciate the stuff he said about some of my videos. Like, I made a long video about the privacy of consciousness, because I think that's like one of the better arguments against illusionism, besides like what we've been talking about. If you're going to try to make an argument against illusionism, I think kind of keying in on the privacy of consciousness, which is one of the features of qualia that they reject, where they're saying like, oh, this is one of the fake things of that, you know, fake concept of qualia. Privacy, no, there is no mental privacy, not really. And I tried to argue that like this is a pretty indispensable part of our, not just our philosophy of mind, but also epistemology. And if you reject the privacy of consciousness, you're going to commit yourself to all kinds of bizarre things epistemically, you know, not just in the philosophy of mind. Like, for instance, you're going to grant that like in principle you could have equally good evidence for your own mind and the mind of like of someone else, or like a non-human animal or something. So like, that seems wrong. It seems like you're always going to have more evidence for the existence of your own mind than anyone else's mind. And, you know, I flesh that out and try to make the commitments clear, and also make it clear why this has real world implications. You know, like, people used to perform surgery without anesthetic on like newborns because they thought, well, newborns can't feel pain. And, you know, I think a mistake like that makes sense given the privacy of consciousness. But, you know, the outward observational empirical data never really changed with respect to, you know, doing surgery on infants without anesthetizing them. But I think that, well, anyway, without launching into the whole privacy thing, I made a video about privacy arguing against illusionism, and I thought Pete Mandick had some interesting thoughts in response to that. But if you want to actually steel man the view, I guess I would talk to him. Or an illusionist, because the only non-physicalist I could think of who can really steel man this view is Philip Goff and I guess David Chalmers. But other than that, you're not really going to get a very sympathetic treatment from like from non-physicalists, right, and even from like most physicalists, because most physicalists don't think this way. Most of them are type B physicalists.
So argument number two, philosophical zombies, whereas I've reconstructed it, it goes something like this. Premise one, if zombies are conceivable, then zombies are possible. Two, if zombies are possible, then mental properties are not identical to physical properties. Three, zombies are conceivable. Four, therefore, mental properties are not identical to physical properties. Is that roughly the argument? What does it mean? What's a philosophical zombie? And what are the implications of those zombies?
Yeah, that's roughly it. There are different versions of the zombie argument that like rely on different assumptions. Like David Chalmers relies on two-dimensional semantics, and you know, you could dispute the argument on those grounds. Like, which, you know, Philip Goff's approach in the book I referenced earlier kind of like goes around that. You don't have to say anything about two-dimensional semantics. You just have to affirm phenomenal transparency. But yeah, that's roughly the argument. And this is, I think, like currently my favorite argument against physicalism. It's the one I guess I find the most persuasive at the moment. But something I want to say at the outset is that zombies are a problem for physicalism for a very particular reason. And I've found that, like, on YouTube, some people don't get why the possibility of zombies is a problem for physicalism. So, if physicalists are saying, hey, consciousness is constituted by the brain, okay, like that, or it's identical to the brain, or something along those lines, then if the brain is there, if the constituents are all there, then the higher order phenomenon should be there. Like, necessarily. If you're saying that X is entirely constituted by Y, then if Y exists, then X necessarily exists. So if it's possible that the constituents are all there, but the higher order phenomenon doesn't obtain, then that seems to indicate that you're wrong about, you know, the constitution relationship or the identity relationship or you know, whatever you're saying as a physicalist. This is like the least controversial premise of the argument, but,
right,
you know, it's disputed. Everything is disputed. People dispute whether water is H2O in philosophy. So, yeah. Like, yes, it's disputed, but, you know, so is everything else. But, yeah, so, like, if you, something like the statue David, this is an example I like from Hedda Hasselmerk, like, the statue David is just a piece of marble that's shaped in a certain way. So if you have that piece of marble, and it's shaped in that way, then you have the statue David. Like, setting aside concerns about, like, is there, like, a contribution from our minds that, like, makes it a statue? Like, do people have to think of it as a statue in order for it to be a statue? Like, setting that aside, you understand what I mean when I say, like, yeah, this statue is just a piece of marble that's shaped a certain way. It's constituted thereof. And if the constituents are there, then you're going to have the statue David. Physicalists are saying the same thing about consciousness. Consciousness is constituted by the physical brain. So, like, if the physical constituents are there, then consciousness should be there. If it's possible that the marble is there shaped in that way, but the statue's not there, then that means we're missing something. Those weren't really the constituents. And the same goes for consciousness. Like, if it's possible, it doesn't have to be actual. Like, just if in some possible world, all the physical brain states are there, but consciousness is not there, then physicalism is false. Okay, so that's like the least controversial premise of the argument.
Right.
Second least controversial is that zombies are conceivable. Just the idea that you could have a body without a mind. That's roughly all it is. It's not like a Walking Dead zombie. It's just, you know, all the physical properties are there. All the atoms are there. Physically, it's the same as you and me, but there's no consciousness. Body without a mind. That's all it is. Some people say that's not even conceivable. I would urge them to try harder. I find it very easy to conceive of this, but if you don't like the zombie case, you could also do like an invert where you have all the physical material there, but like the experiences are different. So like, do you think it's metaphysically possible that like, you know, all the physical constituents are there and we're not saying there's no experience in the invert case. We're just saying that the experiences are different. So like, you know, you hear the sound of a trombone and it sounds slightly deeper or something. Is that possible? Because it's the same problem for physicalism for the same exact reason. So conceivability arguments, you've got zombies, you've got inverts, and you also have ghosts, which is like the reverse image of zombies where you have a mind without a body instead of a body without a mind. That one doesn't as straightforwardly like refute physicalism as the zombie case, but it still can rule out like certain forms of physicalism, and it has some other implications that are philosophically interesting. Ralph Stefan Weir writes about that in his book, The Mind-Body Problem in Metaphysics. But I guess one way of thinking about the conceivability of zombies, and also the possibility, is whether or not God would have the power to create a body without a mind. So, like, if God exists and he was so inclined, could he make a body without a mind? Like, could he make an invert? And, like, intuitively, it seems like that would be within the power of an omnipotent being. But remember, like, physicalists are saying this is impossible. So this is actually beyond the scope of power of even an omnipotent being. It just makes no sense. It's like, you know, it's just like kind of brutally impossible for like type B physicalists. So if you think that it's within God's power to create a zombie, if he'd so chosen, then you think it's possible and then you're done. but, you know, that's just kind of like an intuitive way of motivating it. That's not the argument. But yeah, so if you think that zombies are conceivable and that zombies are a problem for physicalism, like the most controversy comes from the other premise, which is like, okay, because zombies are conceivable, we should think they're possible. Mm-hmm. And like, that's where most of the dispute happens, especially for type B physicalists. So I guess the first thing to say about the link between conceivability and possibility is that no non-physicalist thinks that it holds in like every case. Like, some people immediately, like reflexively, just start rattling off counterexamples where they're like, well, I can conceive of like this or that or the other thing, but it's not possible. So it's useful to divide up different kinds of conceivability and possibility. Like, in terms of possibility, there's metaphysical possibility and there's physical possibility, you know, so no one thinks that zombies are like physically possible. Like whatever the laws of nature are in this universe, like no one is suggesting that, well, except for type A physicalists, I guess, no one is suggesting that zombies are actual. No one who believes in phenomenal consciousness is suggesting that zombies are actual. So, I mean, no one is saying that just because you can like conceive of something that it must be physically possible. We're talking about like a broader kind of possibility here. And in terms of conceivability, you could say there's like prima facie conceivability and ideal conceivability. So like, I have no idea what the 27th digit of pi is. Do you happen to know it?
That would be incredible, wouldn't it? No.
Let's just say that it's 9. I don't know what it is, but we'll just stipulate that it's 9. So if I said, well, do you think it's conceivable that the 27th digit of pi is 7? It's like, well, yeah, in a sense, it's conceivable, but it's not ideally right. Conceivable because once you like work it out, it's like, oh no, it has to be 9. But it's prima facie conceivable that it could be 7, whereas it's not prima facie conceivable that it could be like a banana or something. It's not even the right kind of thing. So like prima facie conceivability and ideal conceivability, you know, different things. There's also positive and negative conceivability. Yes. Negative conceivability is just like, there's no contradiction. Like there's nothing conceptually incoherent about the scenario. Positive conceivability more involves like, you know, imagining the thing, like fleshing it out. It's a little more, it's like a bit of a higher bar, but, excuse me. Most of the time we're just talking about like ideal negative conceivability to metaphysical possibility. So if you have a counterexample to like the link between conceivability and possibility, it should be relevant to that. It shouldn't be an example where it's like, well, something is prima facie conceivable and it's not physically possible. It's like, okay, that's not really a counterexample to what we're saying here as the proponent of the zombie argument. But there are counterexamples though, even to that, and they have to do with, you know, Kripkean a posteriori mm-hmm. necessities. So this is like the most popular objection where it's like, well, hey, it's conceivable that water is not H2O. It's conceivable that it's XYZ or like a basic element or something. But it's nonetheless the case that it's like necessary that water is essentially H2O. And I think this is where the transparency stuff comes in. So like the reason that works with water and H2O is because water is an opaque concept. You can't work it out from the armchair a priori that water is H2O. It's opaque. You have to investigate empirically to find out that it's H2O. I don't think pain is like that. I think that pain is just a feeling, and I think that if you can feel it and reflect on it, then you know what it is, because what it is just a feeling. So I think that phenomenal concepts are transparent in a way that things like water or gold or whatever, those are not transparent concepts. So, and I think we understand the nature of the physical as well. So if we're making, and I can explain that if you like, but I think that we understand the nature of phenomenal concepts. I think we understand the nature of physical concepts, like we grasp these things. So we're in a good position to make a conceivability argument. You know, we're just making an argument to metaphysical possibility from the fact that zombies are negatively, ideally conceivable. But, you know, like I said, I think the real issue just comes down to whether or not we grasp these concepts, because I think this makes sense. Like the idea that if you're going to be making an argument like this, you just need to understand the concepts involved. Like if you grasp the nature of the things that you're talking about, then your conceiving is actually worth something. If you don't, then it's not. So I think that we are in that position here where we do understand phenomenal concepts and we do understand physical concepts. So we're in a good spot to make a conceivability argument.
So let's slow down for a second, because some of these distinctions are confusing me. The positive and negative distinction I get, something is negatively conceivable if we can't detect a contradiction within it. Something is positively conceivable if we can go beyond that and like form a mental image of it happening. What is ideal versus non-ideal conceivability?
So prima facie conceivability is just like, to put it in a very technical way, it's like if someone popped out of the bushes and asked you a question and it immediately made sense to you, like that would, you know, so like I think it's prima facie conceivable that there could be cousins but no siblings. Like if someone just sprung that question on you, like, hey, could there be cousins but no siblings? Is that possible? It's like, yeah, I guess. But you think about it for 10 seconds and it's like, oh, wait, no, because your cousin is just the offspring of, you know, your parents' sibling. So actually, no, that's not conceivable. So, you know, I would say it's not ideally conceivable that there could be cousins but no siblings, but it might be prima facie conceivable.
Okay, so ideally it has to do with like the amount of time you've spent like reflecting upon the conceptual implications.
It's more like, you know, could an ideal reasoner work out from the armchair that this is possible or not, or like conceivable or not?
Got it.
Conceivable. Like, is it a priori that this is, you know, conceivable? And I think in the like cousin's case, you know, you can work it out from the armchair that that's not conceivable.
Right.
But like, you know, it might like at first blush, you know, that's why I brought up the pi example. It's like,
yes.
Do you think it's prima facie conceivable that like such and such digit of pi is 7? It's like, yeah, it's prima facie conceivable, but an ideal reasoner from the armchair, a priori, could work out what that digit is. And they would say, actually, no, it's not conceivable that it's right. That digit. It has to be this other digit.
Now, if I recall from the Chalmers paper where he delineates all of these nice sets of distinctions, he only thinks that positive ideal conceivability entails possibility, right? So what that means is that if you can only negatively ideally conceive of some state of affairs P, you're not going to get the entailment that P is possible. Is that right?
I don't recall exactly. I mean, I think he might say that, but I don't really remember it. But there's also a crucial part, though, where, you know, I think it only entails possibility for him where the primary and secondary attributes collapse, like the primary and secondary qualities. So, like, if there's no distinction between the appearance properties and the essence properties, you know, that's when you're in the spot that you want to be in. And he argues that we are in that spot with consciousness because there is no distinction between the appearance properties and the essence properties. But if you could drive a wedge between those two things, then that would not entail possibility.
Okay. So when we come to philosophical zombies, bodies and brains, qualitative duplicates of our bodies and brains, but devoid of any conscious experience or internal perspective at all, in what sense can we conceive of these? What's the intended kind of conceivability anyway?
Well, like I said, I prefer to put these things in terms of like transparency and opacity. So I think that when we're talking about, is it conceivable that there's a body without a mind? I think that that's like a transparent sentence. So like, I think that if a transparent sentence is ideally conceivable, then it's possible. And because we grasp the nature of those things, like I said, I think phenomenal concepts are transparent. And I think that there are two understandings of like physical concepts here. One of them is transparent and the other one is opaque. So I just want to flag that there. But if we're talking about the first sense of physical concepts, those are transparent, like pure physical concepts, strictly what we are given by physical science, which are like, it's like a mathematical gnomic description. I think that those are transparent concepts as well, because I think that, you know, we're talking about mathematical roles, causal roles, mathematical descriptions rather. And like to know the causal role of a causal property is to know its essence, and to know the mathematical description of a mathematical property is to know its essence. So if we are just strictly talking about what's given to us by physics and nothing else, then I think that those are transparent concepts because they're like causal and mathematical properties, and those are transparent concepts as well. So when we're talking about zombies, like could there be a body without a mind? I think that that is a transparent sentence. And if a transparent sentence is conceivably true, then it's possibly true. So, I mean, that's how I would approach it. If we're talking about physical concepts in the other sense, which, you know, like, because I'm a Russellian monist, I don't actually think physical concepts are transparent. I think that they're opaque. Like, I think that what's given to us by physics is actually not a complete description of the world, of, like, what exists. I think that there needs to be something that sort of answers to this mathematical description. Like, we are abstracting away from the concrete reality. Like, I think that math in general is abstract, and you know, like if we're making a mathematical model, we are abstracting away from the concrete world. So to the extent that we think that mathematical models abstract away from the concrete world, we should think that physics is abstracting away from the concrete reality of an electron. So I think that physical concepts are opaque, and as a side point, that's what makes panpsychism possible. But anyway, I think that if we're talking about, like, if we're kind of simplifying and we're just talking about pure physical properties, like strictly what is given to us by physical science and nothing else, then talking about zombies, we can form that argument so it's a transparent sentence. And because these concepts are transparent, we can say that if they're conceivable, then they're possible. If we're pivoting to talking about physical concepts, as I believe they actually are, as a Russellian monist, I think they're opaque, but I still think that we understand them empirically. And, you know, the deep nature of these physical concepts is not really relevant to make the argument, I guess. Like, once we start veering into that territory, the physicalist is not going to be happy anyway, because we're already veering into, like, a version of non-physicalism. I don't know if this is, like, I feel like I'm making it more complicated than it actually is, but does that make sense?
Well, let me raise an objection to you there, and your response will perhaps clarify some of this. It seems to me that someone could, with some justification, say that most of the time, for all but the most trained neuroscientists, and even they will fail, we're not actually conceiving of a body and brain without consciousness when we claim to be doing so, when we engage in this thought experiment. We're asked in a philosophy 101 class or philosophy of mind class to think about a body and a brain in as much detail as we can, and then ask, can we imagine that, but without phenomenal consciousness? And we say yes. Well, I think what we're really imagining or conceiving in that case is like a body-ish thing with a brain-ish involved. It's kind of like an amorphous blob lacking in detail, and we're saying, can that sort of a thing lack consciousness? And it's like, yeah, sure. But to really get the conclusion that a brain could lack consciousness, wouldn't we need to be able to imagine and mentally represent the brain in all of its complexity, with all of its billions of neurons and trillions of synaptic connections between them? Like, how much detail do you have to be able to supply to an active imagination for it to count as a genuine conception of a thing, and therefore to draw claims of possibility?
I think that if we're talking about negative conceivability, then we just have to ask if there's any like contradiction in the sure. idea of a body without a mind. And I think that that bar is certainly cleared.
Yes.
I don't think there's any like incoherence in the idea of a zombie. But if you're saying like, well, if I try to positively imagine it and like meet all the criteria of like positive conceivability, yeah, that seems harder. But I don't think it's quite as difficult as how you're making it sound. Like, I think that if you're, because, you know, you brought up the setting of like a philosophy 101 class, I think that like, if you encounter philosophical zombies in a 101 class, it's probably going to be in the context of the problem of other minds. And people typically don't challenge the conceivability of that scenario where it's like, oh, what if you're the only mind that exists? How do you actually know that other minds exist? And people usually don't say, well, I can't even conceive of this scenario. I actually have no idea what you're talking about. Like, I'm totally confused by this idea that maybe other people don't have minds. Like, some people actually don't believe that animals have minds. So it seems like it's perfectly conceivable that, you know, you could have a brain and body, a complex organism without a mind. Like, some people think that's actual. Like, some people are, you know, neo-Cartesians about animals. So I think it is, I mean, it's certainly negatively conceivable. There's no, like, hidden incoherence or contradiction in the idea of a body without a mind. But I also think it's positively conceivable, partly on the grounds that no one seems to raise this objection in the context of epistemology when we're talking about the problem of other minds.
Sure.
And secondly, because people sometimes, for some reason, think that animals don't have minds. So it seems like it is both positively and negatively conceivable, but I do take the point that, you know, if you're like, say you're like an expert in like aerodynamics and flight, and someone says, well, I can conceive of a plane flying backwards. And it's like, if you're really an expert in you know, aerodynamics and like the physics involved in physics and engineering of like making airplanes fly, then you might say that's not conceivable. But like the difference there is that you grasp all the concepts involved. So you're like, no, that's actually not conceivable that an airplane could fly backwards. Whereas the person who's saying they can conceive of that does not grasp actually anything that's involved in that scenario. So I think that brings us back to like the transparency point. It's like, do we understand consciousness and do we understand the physical well enough to make this argument? And I think we do. And like, you know, when it comes to the airplane case, the reason that doesn't work is because the person who claims they can conceive of this doesn't actually understand the relevant entities involved. But I don't think that's the position we're in with consciousness.
Mm. What about like a mitigated modal skepticism or a modest modal skepticism along like Peter Van Inwagen's lines, where I can know about the possibility of states of affairs that are just a short distance away from the actual world, so to speak. So it's like, I know that I can go and grab this cup in front of me, as I just did. That's very close to the actual world. And even if I hadn't grabbed it, I could still know that I could have. But as you move further and further out into states of affairs that differ from the way things actually are, to questions about, like, can I conceive of a body without consciousness? Can I... Is God's existence conceivable, the existence of a maximally great being, the existence of other laws of nature? Is it really possible that there could have been different mathematical frameworks and entirely different laws of nature than those that actually obtain? Then Van Inwagen would say, we just don't have access to that, that surpasses our rational faculties, which were given us by evolution, and there's no reason to think that evolutionary theory would have endowed us with this cognitive mechanism to access possibilities well outside of what would have presented themselves to us in a survival context. If you go down that route, then you've undercut, I think, the probably not the conceivability premise, but the claim that conceivability entails possibility. Do you have any sort of like assessment of that epistemology?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I want to say is, well, okay, imagine Peter Van Inwagen in a different world where red things and round things are lawfully correlated. And then he says, well, this far off possibility, this thing we've never observed of like a blue sphere, like, why are we even taking this seriously as a possibility? It's like, well, I'm taking it seriously because I think I know what redness is and I think I know what roundness is.
Yeah.
And that is informing this thought experiment, you know? So I think that the issue just comes back to, like, do we understand the nature of the concepts involved? And if we do, then we're in a good position to make a conceivability argument. If we don't, then we're not. So, you know, I think that, you know, in the red round world, like, Van Inwagen could make this same argument, and I would find it uncompelling in that world as well. But, you know, I actually am kind of sympathetic to some of these, like, you know, mitigated modal skeptic talking points, I guess. Like, I'm not, like, a pure dedicated, like, flag-waving modal rationalist, I guess. I think that that it makes a lot of sense, like, what Van Inwagen is saying, or, like, Felipe Leon with his mitigated modal skepticism. Like, that stuff does make a lot of sense to me, where it's like, look, our notion of possibility should largely be informed empirically. Like, if we're thinking about what's possible, we should lean pretty heavily on our observations. But I do tend to think that we have not observed everything that's possible, like, even physically. So I don't know. Like, it does kind of seem like you're veering into, like, totally unconstrained waters if you say, like, well, even if we haven't observed it, like, maybe it's still possible. Like, I am kind of sympathetic to that, like, where we should, in general, be kind of conservative about what we think is possible. But I'm still enough of a modal rationalist to be like, well, hang on. Like, if you really do grasp the things involved, like, don't you think this would be, like, a recipe for believing false things? Like in the red and round world, like, if there just happen to be things that are lawfully correlated, if the laws of nature are such that things are one way in our world, but God could have created things a different way if he had so chosen. But then we just end up thinking, well, that's not even possible. Like, why? Because you haven't observed it or something close to it. Yeah, it just kind of, it seems like it's going to set you up for forming a lot of false beliefs. Like, I don't see really the motivation for, like, constraining metaphysical possibility to, like, basically what we've observed and, like, you know, short extrapolations from what we've observed. Like, in general, I think it's good to be conservative and, like, be on the safe side. But, like, in these cases, like I said, where, like, for instance, when we're dealing with transparent concepts or concepts where we grasp the essence of the entities involved, then why shouldn't we be able to talk about possibility? And, like, even if it's, if it wildly differs from what we've observed, like, on what grounds would you say, no, you can't do that? Like, yes, you, like, imagine someone who agrees with me that, like, yes, you understand the nature of X and you understand the nature of Y, but you can't talk about, like, far-flung possibilities with X and Y. It's like, it seems like what they're telling me is I don't really understand X and Y. Because, you know, if I did, I would be able to see why these things aren't possible. But yeah, so I think that they too are going to have to reject some of these, like, transparency claims.
Argument number three, the vagueness argument. What are we getting at here? This is the way I understand it, that premise one, if physicalism is true, borderline cases of consciousness are possible. Two, borderline cases of consciousness are not possible. And three, therefore, physicalism is not true. So why don't you walk us through this?
Well, so, I mean, it kind of starts with the observation that consciousness is not vague, whereas most things are. Okay, so, like, it can be vague whether or not a table exists. Like, you could take a table and slowly deform it to the point where it wouldn't really be a table anymore, but it's not not a table. It's, like, in this gray area. And it's the same thing with, like, Sorites' paradoxes, like, you know, when does a heap, when do like, several grains of sand become a heap of sand, or, like, when does some stubble become a beard, or when does someone become bald, or when does someone become rich? It's like, there's not an exact number of hairs that you have to qualify as, like, being bald or not being bald, or, like, an exact penny where it's like, okay, you weren't rich, but now you are rich. Mm. Or, and, you know, the same thing goes with biological concepts. Like, there was no first human being. It was like a gradual, you know, there was a gradual, smooth gradient change, you know, how evolution works. Like, it's not like, you know, a chimp gave birth to a human at some point. You know, there's, like, slow, gradual change. And you can sort of go through that thought experiment with pretty much everything in the macroscopic world, including brains and brain states, where you, like, slowly change it one atom at a time. And it becomes kind of vague whether or not it is still that thing that we started out with. So, like, you know, you could go between red and orange, where it's like, okay, this is definitely red. It's definitely not orange, but I'm going to slowly move across the spectrum. Okay, is this orange? It's like, well, it's not orange, but it's not not orange. it's like in this gray area borderline case. Okay, so the thought is that consciousness is not like that. Like, conscious states can be like that, like, you know, the experience of red to orange, like the example I just gave. So, like, there can be borderline cases of consciousness in that sense, you know, when we're talking about the contents of consciousness. I'm talking about the existence of consciousness, the existence of phenomenal consciousness, whether it's like something to exist or not like anything to exist. So, I'm of the view that there are basically two options here. It's either like nothing, or it is like anything other than nothing, literally anything other than nothing. And those are the two options. It's either like something or like nothing. Some people claim to not have this intuition, and I believe them. It's not like some of the other times where I'm just like, do you really not see that there's like a hard problem at all? You don't even have that intuition. But like, I can kind of appreciate their point of view where they're saying like, okay, if I'm imagining the development of consciousness in a fetus, like, maybe it's kind of like something at, you know, 20 weeks and, like, kind of like something at 24 weeks. And at some point, it's like something. But, you know, maybe there are borderline cases in between, or, like, the evolution of consciousness in the first place. Like, maybe it's not like anything to be a worm. And, like, or maybe it is. But, you know, the point is, like, in the gradual evolution of worms or snails or what have you, maybe there were, like, borderline cases of consciousness somewhere in that history. And I can kind of see where they're coming from with like every property you could name of the worm or the snail. But when it comes to phenomenal consciousness, it does seem like there's going to be this sharp, bright borderline where it went from not like anything at all to like something. And by something, I just mean anything, anything that is not nothing. So, you know, like one analogy I've used before is the problem of why there's something rather than nothing. You know, no one ever says, why is there something rather than nothing? Or I guess a third option is kind of something. Mm-hmm. It's like, because you can just immediately see that, like, well, there's either something or there's nothing. You know, even if it's just one electron, or if it's just some kind of, like, gunk or something, or it's just space-time or whatever. Like, there has to be, like, if there is anything other than nothing, then there is something. You know, there's no borderline case between somethingness and nothingness. So when people set up the question of why is there something rather than nothing, they don't even entertain some kind of borderline case. They just say there's one of these two things. And I think, you know, I'm just adding this one word. Is it like nothing or is it like something? Why is it like something rather than like nothing? And I don't think there are borderline cases between like something and like nothing. I don't know how to convince somebody who doesn't see it the way that I see it, but that is, and I thought this, by the way, when I was a physicalist. Like, I just didn't realize it was a problem for physicalism. I just thought that this was, like, you know, clearly true, that, like, consciousness is sharp, it's not vague. However, physicalism seems to entail that it should be vague. Like, maybe there's one version of physicalism that doesn't have this entailment, but virtually, I mean, every version of physicalism that, you know, people talk about, yeah, it's going to entail that consciousness should be vague. Like, you should expect it, because we're identifying consciousness with brains and with brain states, or saying that consciousness is constituted by brain states. Well, brains admit of borderline cases. Like, you could imagine taking a particular brain state associated with experience and saying, okay, let me just, like, remove one atom from this brain state. Eventually, it's going to become vague whether or not you're still in that brain state, but it's not going to be vague whether or not you're conscious. And, the same goes for, like, you know, all the way down to neurons and, like, neuronal firings. You could imagine removing, like, one atom at a time, and there are going to be vague borderline cases of neurons, of brain states, of brains, you know. But if I'm right that consciousness is not vague in this way, then that seems to pose a problem for physicalism, you know. And it's not just what I'm saying. It's like particular theories of consciousness also seem to imply this, except for integrated information theory, which is not really a physicalist theory. So if you're talking about, like, global workspace theory, or, you know, without any particular neuroscientific theory, it just seems to be the case that physical objects like brains, or, you know, like organisms or what have you, those are going to admit of borderline cases. But if I'm right that consciousness doesn't, how can they be the same thing? Like, it seems like physicalism leads you to expect that consciousness should be vague. If it's not, then that's a violated expectation of physicalism. So, you know, that's roughly the argument. Physicalism leads you to expect that consciousness should, you know, be subject to vague, borderline, indeterminate states, just like everything else, just like brains and organisms. But that doesn't seem to be the case with consciousness. Consciousness acts more like a fundamental property. It's like, it's sharp. It's not vague. It acts more like things that exist at the fundamental level, which I find interesting as a panpsychist.
Well, I shared the intuition that there's no midway between being conscious and not being conscious. There's no third option. However, an equally pressing intuition on the other side is that there's no single instant along a timeline at which point a developing fetus and then baby becomes conscious. It just seems wholly arbitrary for all of the reasons cited and in the how do you say it? How do you say the paradox's name?
Sorites.
Sorites. Yep. The Sorites paradoxes as to why it's just arbitrary that after this point you have a heat, before that point you don't. Are we really to say that at week 20 on the third day, when precisely this brain state develops, that then the fetus is conscious? Or do we think that the development, however counterintuitive, has to go through a continuum of quasi-consciousness into consciousness, and it's just not clear when it goes from totally unconscious to conscious? And the same thing would be I think about arising from general anesthesia. Is there an exact instant when I go from unconscious to conscious? Or do I go through a stage to get there? Again, I don't know how to make that intelligible, but it just seems equally implausible to say that there's some random arbitrary sharp cutoff.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely have that intuition as well. And it does seem like a problem to say that, presumably things weren't conscious and then they became conscious. That's an assumption shared by most people.
Yes.
That the fetus was not conscious and then it became conscious. Or when you're right under general anesthesia, I hope that you're not conscious and then you become conscious. It's possible that you are and you just don't remember any of it, which is terrifying. But, it's possible that just memory comes back online. But that presents a similar kind of arbitrariness worry about maybe we're not going from, let me back up. It's you're still going to have to pick a precise moment, a bright line when things become conscious. If you endorse this vagueness argument, doesn't that seem arbitrary? And isn't that another problem? Well, you could be a panpsychist and you could kind of eliminate that arbitrariness and say that, consciousness is fundamental. And there's no moment when you become conscious. There's no moment where consciousness didn't exist. Things everything is conscious. So that requires a particular type of panpsychism, a reductionist form, which does say everything is conscious. The more popular varieties of panpsychism would actually have this problem that you're describing, because they don't think everything is conscious. They think that everything is this one mental substance, but that doesn't mean that everything that we can point at has a mind or is a subject of experience. Most panpsychists don't think that my water bottle is conscious. But then, that raises this problem of but if consciousness is sharp, then what is the exact moment that a new mind is comes together from these conscious parts? And I think that integrated information theory has a real edge here, because it grants that consciousness is sharp and it presents us with what appears to be a non-arbitrary line where you become conscious. It's at the rate of maximal phi. It's at that moment where the amount of integrated information is greater, in this system than it is in any of its parts, or it itself, or for integrated information theorists, it's I am this conscious system. I have many parts, but the level of integrated information in my brain is higher than that of any of my parts. And it's also higher than, any broader system of which I myself am a part. So it's this is the rate of maximal phi right here. The maximal integrated information is right. It's located in my brain, and they have a specific theory of why that is. So that doesn't seem arbitrary to me. It seems they have a good theory worked out for why this bright line was placed here and not somewhere else. So I think that the non-reductionist panpsychists do have a compelling answer to that. But you could also be a reductionist panpsychist and say, there is no bright line. Everything is conscious. Consciousness is a fundamental property. And at no point do you cross some kind of sharp, bright line and go from non-consciousness to consciousness. So you don't have to worry about that if you're that kind of panpsychist, so you can remove that arbitrariness. The worry there is just that it seems implausible to say that everything is conscious. It seems like the most counterintuitive version of panpsychism that's on offer, but it does eliminate this arbitrariness worry.
Mm. Well, fair enough. Emerson Green, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I wish you all the best luck in your YouTube endeavors. I think philosophy of mind is a growing interest of mine. It's equally as fascinating as philosophy of religion, and I think we have many of the same interests, so I'd love to have you back on the channel again soon. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. And I was telling you this beforehand, but I actually do watch your channel. I can't say that about a lot of other channels, but I do love your show, and I appreciate the guests you have on. So thank you so much for having me.